This episode of New Politics was released on the 4th of June, 2022, and produced on the land of the Wangal people.
Welcome to New Politics. In this episode, the final call of the seats from the 2022 federal election, a new Labor cabinet, and a new Liberal Party leadership team, but it looks very similar to the old leadership team. I'm Eddie Djokovic, editor of New Politics.
I'm David Lewis, gutted I missed out on a ministry.
And a big thank you to our new Patreon subscribers. Thanks for signing up. And if you'd like to support New Politics, you can support us through a Patreon subscription. It's just $5 per month for the Ruby Standard supporter level or $10 per month for the Gold Standard supporter level. But whether it's a subscription or if you just want to listen in, read our material online or buy a t-shirt or buy a book, it's all available at newpolitics.com.au. And all of this is a good way to support independent journalism. The final seat assessments are in from the Australian Electoral Commission, and Labor has won 77 seats from the recent federal election, and that means that they have a majority on the floor of Parliament and can now govern in their own right without having to rely on the crossbench to pass legislation. They were waiting on two final seats, the Melbourne seat of McNamara, where there was a close three-way contest between Labor, the Liberal Party and the Australian Greens, and the New South Wales seat of Gilmore, where the sitting Labor member, Fiona Phillips, she won the seat narrowly against the Liberal Party candidate, Andrew Constance. The Federal Labor Caucus met for the first time as a government since 2013, and the main message Prime Minister Anthony Albanese pushed forward was not to waste any time in government and be focused on the task ahead. And that to me seemed to be a reference to the divisions that occurred during the Rudd-Gillard years. It's hard to win government from opposition, and Labor learnt the hard way that being in government cannot be taken for granted. So it's taken 9 years, but Labor is finally back into government.
It's not an inexperienced cabinet. A lot of them have been around for a long time, and a lot of them are national figures. Penny Wong from South Australia is a nationally known figure. Tanya Plibersek from New South Wales is a nationally known figure. Mark Dreyfus was an outstanding shadow attorney general. So one of the things that the opposition can't really say is that they lack experience or gravitas, which hasn't been an unreasonable call in the past. I think when Whitlam government was elected in 1972, there were very few had been around in 1948 and 1949 and had been ministers. And it was the same in 1983. The amazing thing was is that the Whitlam 1972 cabinet and the Hawke 1983 cabinet were some of the very best cabinets that we'd ever had. I think the Albanese cabinet has the potential, and I don't want to speak too soon because things can and do go wrong, but they have the potential to be one of the very best opening cabinets of any government.
Well, there's quite a few members of the Labor caucus who were in the previous Labor government that ended in 2013, and that includes Anthony Albanese, Tanya Plibersek, Penny Wong, Mark Dreyfus, Tony Burke, Bill Shorten, Mark Butler, Brendan O'Connor, Jason Clare, Julie Collins, and there's a few others as well. So you'd hope that they'd have memories of what happened back in 2013 and that idea that you should never give away government so easily, and that has to exist there as a permanent reminder. But it's hard to see Albanese making the same mistakes that occurred at that time. And you mentioned this before, you can never tell what kind of issues can develop in the future, but Labor should be prepared for a reasonably lengthy period in office. Historically, Labor has been in office throughout Federation for only 30% of all of that time, but it should be able to add to that for at least 3 years anyway.
Paul Keating said that they always give you a second go. Scott Morrison bucked that trend. We spoke about that last podcast. But I think, too, with the number of seats that the Liberal Party have to gain, it's at least a two-term rebuild for them, historically speaking. Of course, we can look at Queensland, where the Newman government had a record majority and were wiped out the next election. But Anthony Albanese is not Campbell Newman. and federal government is not state government, and there's a whole range of other things that perhaps suggest, and we'll be looking at some of these other things later this podcast, perhaps suggest that Labor can plan for at least two terms and possibly a third. That's getting a little bit on the cocky side, three terms, but you can certainly put in six-year plans by now, and that's good governance. What's going to damage, of course, is what damages every government: scandal. You have to hope that your new ministers and new members aren't so arrogant that they undermine the government through poor behaviour, through pushing the rules, underhanded deals, corruption, etc., etc. But again, the caliber of minister seems to be quite high, and really what we should expect from a ministry team, which is something the Abbott, Turnbull, Morrison government was never really able to provide. There were no ministers of quality. Another one of the great premier cabinets was the Howard 96 cabinet. Now, I didn't agree with any of them, but that was a cabinet that was full of very talented and capable people. And that helped, I think, lay the foundation for a long government by the Howard administration. So again, putting in great people should help.
And most of the Labor cabinet positions have transitioned over from opposition. Labor had to find replacements for Christina Keneally and Terry Butler. They both failed to win their seats at the recent election. And the position of Home Affairs, which was meant to be taken up by Christina Keneally, that's now been taken up by Claire O'Neill. For me, the only real surprise is Tanya Plibersek taking up the environment portfolio rather than education. That was a portfolio that she'd held in opposition for many, many years. The media did report that this is a demotion for Plibersek, but the environment was one of the key issues in the last election, and you'd think that this is an area that Labor has to manage very, very well. So why not give that responsibility to one of your better parliamentary performers? I also noted that Don Farrell has also been made Minister for Trade and Tourism. He's a virtual unknown. He's from South Australia. So that, to me, stinks of a factional deal within the Labor Party. But aside from that, it's also got the highest number of women in cabinet. Of the 22 cabinet positions, there are 10 women. And the full ministry of 41 positions has got 19 women in total. So that's a record number. So it's been less than a week, so it'll take a while to work out how good this cabinet really is. But the most essential ministry positions at the moment are Treasury and Finance. And all ministries are important, of course, but Jim Chalmers and Katie Gallagher have got a lot of work to do in these portfolios. They have to turn the economy around and prepare a mini budget in October. So there's lots to do on financial matters at the moment for this new Labor government.
A lot of the work of the Labor government will be the traditional work of Labor governments, fixing up the problems left by the Liberal government before it, or at least future-proofing. There's very little doubt, even amongst the supporters, that the last three governments were economically poor performers. For the Liberal supporters out there, I do acknowledge that there were a couple of things that made it difficult for every government in the world. The pandemic, of course, made things a little bit harder. Plus, the environment made things a little bit harder. Of course, we could now go on a 20-minute exploration of why the environment made things harder. And if blame can be afforded, who gets that blame? But not a lot of substance was achieved, but a lot of money was spent. And that's something that Jim Chalmers has already pointed to, that things aren't quite as good as it seemed. And of course, a wily government can use this type of stuff to wiggle out of promises it didn't really mean. And I'm not about to guess which ones those are, but also to gain political and factional and cultural advantage over stuff that it did mean but isn't ready to do. So it's going to be a challenging time. I think there's going to be people who are very disappointed when they find that the government can't be the quick change that everybody would like. But the ship of state takes a little while to turn around, and it may take 2 to 3 terms of reform and correction to get right. We lost 9 years in terms of environmental management, in terms of welfare management, in terms of pandemic management. We didn't lose 9 years for that, of course, but we did lose a couple. And that type of stuff takes time to fix. And of course, with media outlets like ourselves watching and critiquing where appropriate, that doesn't make things any easier. But all governments should be held to account.
Well, the other factor is that you can do all of that hard work, cleaning up the economy, cleaning up the environment, doing all of that hard work over one, two or three terms and not be politically rewarded for all of that as well. I guess that's one thing that the Labor government will be wary of. But I guess there's a lot of projects and a lot of tasks that they have to embark at the moment. And they do have to do a lot of work to turn the economy around. They do have to do a lot of work to turn the environment around. And there's a whole range of other issues, as we've explained so many times before, that have been pretty much neglected over the past 9 years. But this is the opportunity to rectify a lot of those problems and provide for a better future.
There's a sense in which it's a thankless task. As I said, all we can do is what we've always done, applaud the good stuff and point out the bad stuff in the hope that people notice it and try and fix it.
The Arts Minister, Tony Burke, he has declared that the era of neglect and contempt for the arts and creative industries is over, and he's looking forward to deliver a better future for Australia's creative sector. Now, we can't actually say what that is because it hasn't been announced yet, but during the week there was another musical reference that appeared in politics, and that was when Albanese was asked about why Christy McBain was given a portfolio after only being in politics for just over 2 years, and this is what he had to say about that.
Christy McBain is outstanding. Christy McBain, someone who I approached personally and to run for the seat of Eden Monaro. If we hadn't won that seat of Eden Monaro, politics might have been a bit different. Christy McBain was a real factor in that. It's not a matter of, you know, a Billy Bragg song, just because you're going forward doesn't mean I'm going backwards.
And Billy Bragg and Albanese have known each other for some time, and Billy Bragg responded by saying that it was great news that Albanese had become Prime Minister and gives hope for British Labor at their election, which is over 2.5 years away. And he also said that Albanese had a socialism of the heart. And that was picked up by a few people in the media, most notably Sky News. Now, they do go absolutely feral whenever anyone in public life mentions socialism, but it barely caused a ripple this time around. So maybe socialism is becoming more acceptable in the newsrooms of News Corporation.
I think when it comes to Sky News, they're devastated. They thought that they had more influence than they did. They thought that they'd be able to pull off another sneaky victory for the party. A couple of the commentators have gone completely unhinged. Rowan Dean, in that quote you played last week, of course, he said that it was the bedwetters of Scott Morrison who took away the true values of the Liberal Party. We're seeing a media that, at least this election cycle, had very little influence and are kicking out against it.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au, and you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
It waves above our infant nights, when all our heads in darkest night. It witnessed many a deed and vow, we mustn't change its colour now. Raise the scarlet standard high, in its foes we'll live and die. No cowards flinch and traitor sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. It well recalls the triumphs past, it gives the hope of peace at last. The banner bright, the symbol plain of human rights and human gain. Raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live or die.
The Liberal Party has new leadership, and Peter Dutton has been appointed as the leader of the Liberal Party, and Susan Lee is the deputy leader. The job of the leader just after a massive election loss is one of the most difficult in politics. Labor had to rebuild itself in 2013 under Bill Shorten, and the Liberal Party had to rebuild itself in 2007 under Brendan Nelson, and there's always a chance that the Liberal Party can return to office in the near future. But you have a look at them and you've got to say that it's going to take a long, long time for this to happen. Peter Dutton doesn't seem to have the intellectual firepower to lead the party back into office. Susan Lee is a nondescript leader who seemed quite disinterested during the last term of parliament. And there doesn't seem to be anyone waiting in the wings for the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party always wants to make that connection and a continuation of the Howard years, but that ended 15 years ago. And Peter Dutton also wants to continue with the division and the culture wars of the Abbott and Morrison era. But it really is time for the Liberal Party to start afresh and modernise the party and make it more relevant to today's world.
One thing they didn't notice about the Howard government is that it stepped away from the whole Menzies infrastructure while still trying to suggest Menzies was in there and that Menzies would have approved. Menzies, of course, had stopped being Prime Minister in 1966 and the government eventually lost office in 1972 to the Whitlam government. And Fraser was successfully able to suggest Menzies, partly because Fraser had a very similar philosophy to Menzies. But also, for a lot of voters, Menzies was still within living memory. It's getting harder to evoke the spirit of Bob Menzies, as there's not so many people alive who can remember him 60 years ago, just about. And that means that the youngest voters will be 78, and then you'll get people under that who remember. But how many kids were engaged then? There were some, and I'm not going to, if you're a 70-year-old who remembers chanting against Bob Menzies, I'm not saying you didn't do that or that you can't remember. But it's a smaller number than, say, being able to recall the Turnbull years, for example. And I'm not sure many people are doing that anyway, but you know what I mean. It's a big job to reform the party, and it's a job that is a bit self-sacrificing. It's not often that the people who do the hard work of reforming the party get through to office. Usually they have to lose that election, but all the work's been done and the next electoral cycle is taken up with the new and improved party going through with a different leader. And that's horrible and unfair, but welcome to life. Life is horrible and unfair sometimes. I don't know what they're going to do. Peter Credlin on Sky, I saw a clip of it. It was reported as that she said that the trouble was that the Liberal Party should be more right-wing, when in fact what she said was a little bit more nuanced than that. And I'm not a fan of Peter Credlin, don't get me wrong, but I do think it's fair to report exactly what they argue. What she said was the Liberal Party has to make a choice. Either it's a moderate party or it goes further to the right. That what she saw as the compromise, which ended with Morrison, didn't work. And I think that's actually not unreasonable. I don't think going hard right works, given how it was the independents and the moderate independents who did remarkably well, whereas the hard right parties were pretty much wiped out. But I don't think Peter Credlin would ever say that she'd want to see things become more moderate.
And the media is trying its best to gloss up Peter Dutton as well. Here's Samantha Maiden from News Corporation giving it a go.
He is very well liked within the party, much more than Scott Morrison, for example. He does have that kind of Queensland copper's sense of humour. So he has that sort of dilemma where his reputation outside the party is people make fun of him for looking like a potato, very unkind, and there's a list of various transgressions that is used. But I think he has pretty good relationships within the party.
I'm not quite sure what the Queensland copper sense of humour is, but it might be walking out of the acknowledgement of the Stolen Generation speech in 2008. It might be locking up asylum seeker children in detention. It might be making up jokes about high water levels for Pacific Island nations. It might be driving Aboriginal children out to remote parts of the city, dumping them without shoes and making them walk home, which is what Peter Dutton did when he was a police officer. So all of these incidents are not very funny at all, so I'm not sure what this Queensland copper sense of humour is. Here's the Premier of Western Australia, Mark McGowan, giving his assessment of Peter Dutton.
He's an extremist. He's an extremist. And I don't think he fits with modern Australia at all. And he doesn't seem to listen. He's extremely conservative. I actually don't think he's that smart. I've seen him present on things. I don't really pick up there's much there.
Do you want to see?
As opposed to Morrison, Scott Morrison, is a clever guy. I don't pick up Peter Dutton is fit to be Prime Minister.
You can never write off any political leader. We have to remember that John Howard was written off in 1988. That's when he had an approval rating of just 18%. 8 years later, he became Prime Minister and was in government for 11 years. But Howard had some conservative intellectual rigour about him. It was a particularly bad level of conservative intellectual rigour, but you just don't see that with Peter Dutton. In the 2018 leadership challenges against Malcolm Turnbull, he was outsmarted by Scott Morrison, and in 2022, he's not clever enough to refuse the leadership. This has got the feel of, well, hang on, it's my turn at the leadership, and it's probably a case where nothing was going to stand in the way of Peter Dutton becoming the Liberal Party leader.
He was elected unanimously, and I suppose congratulations to him. Nobody stood against him. And the first thing he does is talk about the forgotten people, which is, of course, is Menzies' great phrase from that 1943 speech, which starts the rebuilding of the non-Labor parties into an electable and vital force in Australian politics. And the forgotten people, in Menzies' view, was that expanding middle class. Now, the middle class was to expand a lot more in the 50s and 60s than it did in the 20s and 30s, but it had already started that expansion. And Menzies was part of this expansion. He came from a fairly lower middle class background and had, through dint of hard work and talent, got his way into an elite private school and then into Melbourne University and then into a top law firm and then into politics and Attorney General and then Prime Minister before it all going horribly wrong for him. But Menzies did believe in the system, and he said he wanted to represent essentially that expanding middle class. What the Liberal Party did over the last 9 years was contract the middle class quite substantially. It's harder to move up. And to use the term forgotten people when you've just got out of government and out of a fairly electorally successful government is not a great indication of his intellectual rigour.
Well, it's a very strange type of rhetoric to use. As you mentioned, this is something that opposition parties that have been in opposition for some time, this is the rhetoric that they use. Menzies used it in the 1940s. John Howard referred to it a little bit in the 1980s, and it's hard to know who these forgotten people are. Is it all these people that have been forgotten by the coalition over the past 9 years? And Labor just hasn't been in for long enough to have any forgotten people there. So it just seems to be this confused mess of ideas that he's pushing through. The other factor is that Dutton wants to, or he said that he wanted to present himself as a new kind of leader, some kind of Renaissance guy, that he wanted the public to see a different side to his personality. But so far, it's the same old Peter Dutton. He said that the next challenge is the school curriculum. And I'm not sure why. He's just finished 9 years in government. Surely all of these issues relating to the school curriculum could have been implemented by the coalition over the past 9 years. But it's probably best to stop this confusion of ideas, forget about the forgotten people because they no longer exist, but it would be best if the Liberal Party just accepted that they are going to be out of office for some time and they really need to go away and do the reform that they've resisted for such a long time.
It's so oddly bizarre. They do need to think about what type of party is the Liberal Party. Is it the party of moderation? Is it the party where you would have members such as Monique Ryan, such as Kylie Tink, such as David Pocock, and they would make up your core? Or do you go harder and have people like Peter Dutton and Suzanne Ley and try and make them electable? Now, both of them won their seats, so clearly they are electable, at least in their own seats. But are they national figures? I think the party is in shock and it's in grief, and that's fair enough. I'm not going to laugh at someone who just lost an election, no matter how deservedly. There's a lot of Liberal Party members who are very upset. A businessman has been called on to apologise for name-calling. I think it was Macaulay Cash, who he blamed for losing the party. And this is the type of person I've always been somewhat defending, the Liberal Party member who is in there to push the Liberal Party values. And when you have a government that's not pushing any values, and of course we could have the huge argument of, or what values did the last years have, but certainly the people who pay up their membership, who go to branch meetings, who push for the party every day, I think have been feeling very let down over the last couple of years. And it's all come home to roost. I don't agree with name calling. I think I understand where the anger is coming from. And I think the Liberal Party in the most extreme might have to do what it did in 1943 and totally destroy itself and rebuild from the bottom. And it got back within two election cycles. Now, partly there was a vacuum, but also partly it was a professional and united and competent party that was ready for government in 1949.
But overall, it's not often that a government loses office and it almost sinks without a trace. What is the legacy of those 9 years of coalition government? What did they achieve over those years? What did Scott Morrison achieve over the almost 4 years of being in the position of the Prime Minister? So what we've got left at the moment is a Liberal Party that's intellectually bankrupt. It's actually bankrupt in the division of Western Australia. It's administratively bankrupt in New South Wales. They've got a new federal leader who is woeful and hasn't got much intellectual or electoral appeal. And now, it would be a mistake to dismiss the chances of any political party looking into the future, but it looks like there's a very difficult political road for the Liberal Party to take if they're ever going to make it back into office in the short term.
It's going to take more discipline and I think more intelligence than the current leadership team have.
So there is new leadership for the Liberal Party. There's also new leadership for the National Party as well. Barnaby Joyce has been dumped and David Littleproud is the new National Party leader. The National Party didn't actually lose any seats at the election but decided to take on a new direction. And
Back in 2018, I wrote an article for New Politics saying that Barnaby's career was dead. When he got elected back to the leadership, I didn't change my mind at all, and it was right. He achieved absolutely nothing in the last few years, however long he was leader for. They'd been propping him round Weekend at Bernie's style, and I can't see how he can come back now. David Littleproud has the leadership. He might not be any better. He might be much better. It is, in fact, a bit early to tell from a minor opposition party with absolutely no say. But it's certainly the case that we've had the funeral. It's that point at the service where we're just walking away from the grave, I suspect.
Well, you did write that article in 2018 predicting that was the end of Barnaby Joyce. Maybe it took him a long time to actually get to the article, but 4 years later, that probably is the end of Barnaby Joyce as a political career.
The corpse twitched for another few years. Nobody should have been surprised. The only surprise really is why did he run for it? I suppose the National Party didn't lose a seat. He claimed that they'd gained a couple, but that was wrong. But they didn't lose any, which was, again, a pretty remarkable effort. They're no longer part of the coalition. What a lot of people don't understand is that the coalition doesn't hold while the parties are in opposition. They're separate parties because there's no point in voting in a block in opposition, particularly when your votes have no say. The parties will still work closely together, no doubt, but it'll be interesting to see what the Littleproud years do.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au. And you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
And just looking at some of the early actions of the new Labor government, Australia's foreign minister, Penny Wong, she's made a few lightning visits to the countries in the Pacific region. As a result, Fiji has shelved plans for future cooperation with the Chinese government, as have 10 other Pacific nations. And that's not to suggest that these issues have been fully resolved now, but all it took was for some high-level negotiations and some interest from the Australian government. And it's never easy with these negotiations, but it seems that the previous coalition government was negligent on foreign affairs, and you're left wondering, well, what exactly was Maurice Payne doing as foreign affairs minister during all of that time? There were those trade disputes between Australia and China, and Australia suffered massive drops in export revenues in key sectors and two-way trade with China. We had the fiasco with the cancelled French submarines deal, and then there was the issues with the Solomon Islands as well. And foreign affairs, to me, that was indicative of so many of the previous government's failings. Relationships with other countries can be repaired, but it seemed that Morrison either didn't care, was doing his best to damage the relationships with key trading partners and allies. And it shouldn't have got to this stage, but it did. And it might take a little while to clean up the mess left behind by the coalition.
Within a week, Penny Wong had already made a mark. And I would argue she's done more than the last three or four foreign ministers. The Liberal government was trying to wheedle its way back into Europe or back into America and align itself with Trump. And I think a lot of Maurice Payne's duties were for that. Meanwhile, China gets into the Solomon Islands. Now, once a capable and intelligent foreign minister gets through, China realizes it's overstepped its mark, it's tried to do things too quickly, and that the normal rules are back on the table, so that it can't sort of promise things that it can't deliver because Australia will be watching. And there's no sense of all of this that there's going to be war. This is normal, everyday foreign affairs. This happens all the time. Countries assert their rights. Other countries try and assert back or step back whatever's in their best interests. The fact that we have a very good foreign minister leaves me with maybe just a little bit of hope. And hopefully she hasn't fiddled her travel allowances, or, and I'm pretty sure she hasn't. Hello, staff from Penny's office who listen, I'm joking. It is remarkable what competence can bring to a government.
A few listeners have asked about the music that we use in each episode, and we do have a Spotify list. Search for New Politics Podcast Music in Spotify, and there's also a song list for each episode at newpolitics.com.au. That's it for this episode of New Politics. Thanks for listening in. If you'd like to support our style of journalism and commentary, please make a donation at our website at newpolitics.com.au. We don't beg, plead, beseech, or gaslight you about journalism coming to an end. We just keep it very simple. If you like what we do, please send some support our way. It keeps our commitment to independent journalism ticking along. I'm Eddie Djokovic. Thanks for listening in, and it's goodbye to our listeners.
I'm David Lewis. We'll see you next time.